I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Homeland and Zero Dark 30 give us the Hollywood version of what it's like to be a CIA intelligence officer hunting down terrorists in far-flung parts of the world. Our guest, Neda Bakos, worked for the CIA for 10 years, first in the HR department, then as an analyst, and finally as the chief targeting officer tracking down Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a particularly vicious terrorist who targeted Shiites, the U.S., and its allies during the war in Iraq. Neda Bakos and her team were tasked by the Bush administration with finding a connection between al-Qaeda, Saddam Hussein, and the September 11th terror attacks. And even though they determined there was no link, the administration continued to push that narrative as a reason for the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. That's what Bakos writes about in her new book, The Targeter, My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House. She sued the U.S. government before the book's publication because they blacked out so much of the manuscript. She left the CIA, now works as a consultant, and is a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute here in Philadelphia. And Neda Bakos, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start in the beginning. You saw an ad for a job at the CIA. You happened to be in Washington at the time. What was your interest in that organization?
At the time, I really was focused on living overseas, and there just weren't a lot of private sector opportunities. So I saw an ad in The Economist, and I went ahead and applied.
What was the ad for?
It was just for general ad for the CIA. They were recruiting for analysts and operations officers.
You started in the HR department, which is kind of an unusual place for a targeter to begin, but how come?
I did. I had a little bit of professional background in HR, and when I went and looked through the jobs on the website, I realized I could easily fill the role of this organizational development job. And I thought, this is going to be less competitive than some of the analysts and operations officers. And this was during right toward the end of the Clinton administration. So there wasn't a lot of hiring in the federal government at that time. And so I went ahead and applied for that role.
And ended up being a target. You were an analyst for a while, which, as you described, seems like someone who is just looking through reams and reams and reams of data. Yes?
Yeah, so an analyst is charged with digesting all of the types of raw intelligence that comes in. And then their job is actually to turn it into a product. So it's briefing the policymaker, writing a product like the presidential daily brief for the policymaker so that they can understand the CIA's bottom line or assessment on any given topic in national security.
And what does a targeter do? That was your final job at the CIA.
Yeah, and I moved over to the operations side and became a targeting officer. And that's really similar in the role that it's a synthesis of information, but it's you apply it tactically. So you use that information to then take action upon.
As you said, this was after the Clinton, the very tail end of the Clinton administration. Was it unusual for women to have the kind of jobs that you had at the CIA at that time?
No, it wasn't. I mean, by the time I transitioned to the targeting role and even analyst, it was under the George Bush administration. But especially in the Counterterrorism Center, there were a lot of women as analysts and working as targeting officers, even though that role hadn't really come to fruition yet. Prior and run up to 9/11. It just wasn't the sort of quote-unquote sexy place to work yet.
Oh, so interesting.
Women were interested in the extremism and just following groups like al-Qaeda. And there wasn't an immediate payoff in their career path, but they went ahead and stuck with it, and that's how come there was largely women in that role.
Do you think women bring something different to that kind of work?
Not necessarily, no. I think you need diverse outlooks, regardless, whether it's race or gender. You need people to sit down at the table and have some kind of diverse discussion so that everybody can weigh in on some solutions.
We just marked the 18th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks, and you write in this book that you said immediately when you saw what was happening at the World Trade Center, obviously attacked by two airplanes, you said, this is al-Qaeda. Why did you think that?
Well, I wasn't even in the Counterterrorism Center at the time, but I was able to read some of the intelligence that I had clearance to read that was being presented to policymakers. And there was a lot of information about al-Qaeda around that time period wanting to attack the United States. So it just wasn't a mystery to anybody at that point.
I remember it was the summer of 2001, and there was this now infamous presidential daily brief given to President Bush at the time, basically saying Al-Qaeda determined to attack the United States, or words to that effect. And obviously, in hindsight, that seems like that was just sort of screaming at the administration that something was imminent. Did you see it that way?
I mean, especially when you go back and look at what the 9/11 Commission had determined, and you read through the language of that PDB, it does seem imminent. It just, you don't have the time and the place. And so it's difficult to harden targets or do anything proactive. But at the same time, a lot of effort should have been pointed toward collecting intelligence and focusing on Al-Qaeda.
You described the time after the September 11th terror attacks and obviously trying to briefing the administration about who's behind this, where are the threats. But you also described this real serious conflict within the administration, I guess, between what, CIA and Rumsfeld and others in the Bush administration.
Yeah, in the run-up to the Iraq War, I was working on the team that was charged with analyzing whether or not Al-Qaeda had anything, Iraq had anything to do with Al-Qaeda in 9/11. And we found that it did not, and that was prior to the war. And we delivered all those findings to the policymaker. But regardless of that, there was pushback within elements of DOD and within elements of the White House, particularly the Vice President's office. So we did have a lot of, I guess, conflict around that discussion because that's not the narrative they really wanted to hear.
In fact, you say the Office of Special Plans was created by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to essentially do their own research separate from what the CIA was doing.
Correct. So that was really just to supplant and minimize what the intel community was coming up with and trying to form and shape the opinion either of other policymakers or of the public. It wasn't very successful. They were really bad at what they did. But at the same time, this is really what I thought was sort of the seeds of trying to spin the narrative in the news to make it sound like if you just say these two names connected often enough, it appears that there is a connection. And I felt like that's what was happening.
And the two names were Saddam Hussein
and Al-Qaeda.
Where was George Tenet in all this? I mean, as there were conflicts between people like you who were doing the research and the Bush administration.
So he has since written a book, of course, based on this. And I didn't brief him or have access to him at the time because I was a, you know, mid-level analyst. Mm-hmm. But, you know, according to his memoirs, he was really focused on trying to, one, push the narrative of dealing with 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. And then we know the infamous slam dunk comment. He does go in to explain some context around that in his book as well. But I was not focused on the WMD side. I was focused on the Al-Qaeda piece.
Let me play something. We're reliving some history here, but it's such critical and important history, and I still think there are lessons to be learned that we did not learn from the Iraq War and also what happened leading up to the Iraq War. This is Secretary of State Colin Powell, his now famous speech before the United Nations. It's February 5th, 2003, making the case for the war in Iraq. And in this section, he draws on connections between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, specifically using Abu Musab al-Zarqawi as the link. Let's give it a listen.
Iraq today harbors a deadly terrorist network headed by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, an associate and collaborator of Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda lieutenants. When our coalition ousted the Taliban, the Zarqawi network helped establish another poison and explosive training center camp, and this camp is located in northeastern Iraq. Zarqawi's activities are not confined to this small corner of northeast Iraq. He traveled to Baghdad in May 2002 for medical treatment, staying in the capital of Iraq for 2 months while he recuperated to fight another day. During this stay, nearly two dozen extremists converged on Baghdad and established a base of operations there. These Al-Qaeda affiliates based in Baghdad now coordinate the movement of people, money, and supplies into and throughout Iraq for his network. And they've now been operating freely in the capital for more than 8 months.
So as you watched that speech, I remember watching it as well. What was your reaction?
At the time, we actually had been able to see the speech, the draft speech that he was going to be giving. And we were able to weigh in on the analysis piece of that. But our version that was sent back to the White House was changed by the time he spoke at the UN. So we, from our perspective, it was inaccurate. This wasn't the changes that we gave the White House, and this wasn't the analysis that we gave the White House. Zarqawi was a street thug that grew up in Jordan. He was co-located in Afghanistan next to al-Qaeda in the late 90s. He never bought into the ideology of al-Qaeda in the sense of, like, attacking the United States. He was radicalized and extremist and believed in the same radicalization tenets that al-Qaeda did. But his focus was the Jordanian kingdom until 9/11 when we invaded Afghanistan, and he fled as well. And by that time, he was co-located with another local terrorist group in northern Iraq called Ansar al-Islam.
Right.
And that's the poisons network and the poisons lab that they're talking about and discussing, because this was also a brand that Zarqawi was trying to build as, like, known as the bioweapons terrorist expert. It was rudimentary at best. But I go into all of this in my book where, this back and forth with the speech,
right,
and how disjointed it was by the end.
I'm curious about, as you said, you and your team sent some changes over to, I guess, Colin Powell or the Bush administration about Zarqawi in particular. What, if anything, did you want the Secretary of State to say about Zarqawi?
Zarqawi had never joined al-Qaeda at that point. He wasn't interested in joining al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda wasn't particularly interested in him. There was one senior al-Qaeda member that had been advocating for him to join when they were in Afghanistan. Bin Laden had zero interest. Just, he wasn't considered to be worthy, I think, at that time.
Zarqawi wasn't?
Yes, of joining al-Qaeda. He was just a, you know, bold street thug that was trying to build his own brand. So to say that he was al-Qaeda and it had any link to 9/11 was disingenuous at best, in addition to the fact that he didn't have a cell in Baghdad working, and there wasn't knowledge by the regime that we ever uncovered that he was trying to build any kind of al-Qaeda brand. They knew he was in northern Iraq, but they had very little to do with northern Iraq at that point, Saddam's regime.
We're almost up in a break here, but it seems like the Bush administration was using then Zarqawi to say that there is some kind of connection between Saddam Hussein and September 11th, and that connection is Zarqawi.
Yes, that's 100% what they were trying to do.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Neda Bakos. She's written a book about her time in the CIA. It's called The Targeter, and it's subtitled My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House. She spent about 10 years with the CIA and in part tracking down this Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And he was a particularly vicious terrorist, it must be said. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Neda Bakos, again, former CIA analyst, author of The Targeter, My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House, is written with David Coburn. She's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is here in Philadelphia. In fact, she's speaking tonight at the National Liberty Museum at 6:30. Let's talk more about Zarqawi. You describe, he was, as you said, born in Jordan, one of 10 children. He was, as you describe, a thug and a drunk. Help us understand, I guess, his pre-terrorist life.
He was, I guess, in some respects, a rebellious teenager. He spent some time in and out of jail. He was drinking a lot, doing drugs, getting into trouble, you know, criminal activity. So by the time that he had spent one of his last criminal sentences in jail, he met a cleric that introduced him to the tenets of radical Islam.
Wow. Well, but until that point, there was nothing political or...
Not at all.
Radical, at least radically political or any...
He was just a regular old criminal.
Covered with tattoos, correct?
Yes, he was. He had a nickname called the Green Man because of his tattoos.
And while he was in prison and becoming radicalized, he removed his tattoos with a razor blade. I mean, I'm just trying to understand what that, the pain of doing
right.
something like that.
That's how seriously he was embracing the radicalization. So he took this on, you know, very quickly and very seriously and adopted that extremist point of view and decided he was going to start his own organization. At this point, his anger was really just directed toward the Jordanian kingdom.
So he comes out of prison, and where does he go next? I mean, where does he go to sort of foment his radical ideas?
He spends a lot of time in Jordan doing that and meeting with this cleric, but he also ends up co-located in Afghanistan with al-Qaeda.
And is this before?
This is before 9/11 right. in the late 90s. And so he's building his own brand. He's recruiting those that haven't been drawn to either al-Qaeda or were not accepted by al-Qaeda. So those people from the Caucasus, some people from North Africa that didn't have connections within al-Qaeda, and those that were just more interested in the street fighter of Zarqawi versus the philosopher of bin Laden.
Which is so interesting. I mean, as outsiders, there's so much we do not know about these various terrorist organizations. But it seemed that al-Qaeda took one look at him and said, you know, you're not one of us. I mean, that your methods are not our methods.
Right. Well, he didn't even have a chance yet to build that brand for them. He was just distinctly not up to par, I guess, for bin Laden and Zawahiri at that point.
And it seemed that his fight was more internal, whereas with al-Qaeda, it was more about foreigners.
Correct.
Who were, you know, located or had designs on parts of the Middle East.
Right. So Zarqawi was really just focused on the Jordanian kingdom at that point.
So September 11th happens here in the United States. Where is Zarqawi when all this is going on?
So he's been in and out of Afghanistan, and then he ends up fleeing Afghanistan, goes through Iran, and ends up in northern Iraq, where he finds a safe haven with Ansar al-Islam and ends up staying there with them to build this, like, rudimentary bioweapons lab. And it's very rudimentary. It's not anything that really could be deployed easily, what they're building. It was very crude. And the United States intelligence apparatus has been watching him. They right. understand where he is in the run-up to the Iraq War. And at that time, we even had an opportunity to take out his bioweapons lab and his whole network at that point prior to the Iraq War.
But we didn't.
We did not.
Why not? Do you know why?
I still don't understand the decision-making behind that as to why we did not do it.
When you say northern Iraq, was this the Kurdish part of Iraq? Is that where he was?
Yes, it was.
Is that significant?
It's significant in the fact that this is not something that Saddam had control over. His regime was not controlling that part of the territory so much that to make this link that Zarqawi was working with Saddam, you know, just because of even where he was located was tenuous at best.
We heard Colin Powell saying, well, he went to Baghdad to get medical care, that somehow that was a link that the Bush administration was trying to make. You've got this look on your face.
Right. So there was never evidence that Saddam's regime knew anything about treatment of Zarqawi being wounded. And when you think about trying to track down a criminal in the United States, even some of the most wanted, it's very easy for them to disappear and become one of the many in a crowd. And it's the same thing. When you're looking for a terrorist, and for Saddam to not know Zarqawi was in Baghdad, that is entirely plausible.
Why do you think the Bush administration, the United States government, was so interested in invading or so determined to invade Iraq? I mean, it was clearly WMDs that turned out not to be true, and it was this terrorist, Zarqawi.
I think there were elements within the Bush White House that were really focused on Iraq, even right after 9/11. And there's lots of speculation as to why, whether it was a leftover vendetta that didn't come to fruition earlier within other administrations. It's hard to tell, but we do know that the vice president's office and Donald Rumsfeld were definitely interested in taking out Saddam's regime. I think they really thought if they removed this linchpin within the Middle East, it would somehow spread democracy magically across the Middle East like glitter. Obviously, we know that did not happen.
Right. You quote President Bush saying, Iraq has also provided al-Qaeda with a chemical and biological weapons training. Is this weapons that you said is pretty low level? Is that what he's referring to there?
Yeah.
We also know that Iraq is harboring a terrorist network. Now, headed by a senior al-Qaeda terrorist planner, referring to Zarqawi.
Right. So we knew he was not part of al-Qaeda. Saying that he's an al-Qaeda planner, I think somehow got them around the language of him being a member. Mm-hmm. But it still draws the connection, and it's not accurate.
I do want to play a clip from President Bush. This is a cabinet meeting in 2004. But Zarqawi headed this organization called al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Eventually.
Now, when did that happen?
He ends up joining al-Qaeda after the invasion in 2004. So everything that the administration was looking for, that linkage, we end up driving that by invading Iraq, and he ends up joining al-Qaeda in 2004. And we know this because we saw the communications and the agreements between the two organizations.
So our invasion led to Zarqawi becoming essentially a part of al-Qaeda.
Yes, and growing his brand.
You said brand several times.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean in non-CIA parlance?
That means he was able to draw recruits and money and get weapons and explosives and become a much bigger terrorist organization than he would have ever thought of being prior to this invasion.
Let me play this clip. This is, again, President Bush. It's a cabinet meeting. It's 2004, and he's defending the decision to go to war with Iraq and defending this link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and he does mention Zarqawi. Let's give it a listen.
Now, he was a threat because he had terrorist connections, not only al-Qaeda connections, but other connections to terrorist organizations. Abu Nadal is one. He was a threat because he provided safe haven for a terrorist like Zarqawi, who is still killing innocent inside of Iraq. Now, he was a threat, and the world is better off, and America is more secure without Saddam Hussein in power.
Let me ask you about Zarqawi, because he was particularly violent, it should be said, in many ways targeting Shiites as much as he was targeting Americans or even foreigners in Iraq.
Right. So Zarqawi was really okay with just sowing chaos. His MO is essentially to create this chaotic environment that the United States and military forces were unable to quell the tide of. And he was pretty successful at this for at least a couple of years. He was then working to pit these two religious, long-term sort of infighting against each other between the Shia and the Sunni. And this really wasn't even for him about attacking the Shia necessarily in the sense of what they believed in, although he didn't have a lot of empathy for them. This was really to create some kind of chaos.
Or he was something.
Yes, he was a Sunni.
So he sort of thrived in chaos then.
That was his whole strategy, and it was pretty successful.
This is so hard to talk about, but you described the beheading of Nicholas Berg, and you've actually seen the video of what happened.
Yes.
And there's our Zarqawi, right?
Yeah, we ended up having to, of course, watch this. And it wasn't – this is kind of one of the first times something like this was dispensed by a terrorist organization with public access. And we had to analyze the video. We had to figure out who was in the room, if Zarqawi was present, where they were, just to give us any kind of information to find him.
Must have been horrifying to look at.
Absolutely. And of course, since then, we've seen ISIS dispense horrific images. So this was just sort of the beginning of that.
And there was Zarqawi, right?
And Zarqawi was in the room, yes. He was one of the people who actually did the beheading.
Do you think that sort of after the war, after the invasion of Iraq, and Zarqawi then becomes a full-fledged terrorist in Iraq, that in a way sort of has become justification for the Bush administration's invasion? You know what I mean?
I think that that's how they tried to spin it. And I do think just because of all the violence coming to fruition, it was easy to say, look, we really needed to go after this person. This person was bad. But at the same time, they knew that Zarqawi was not the type of terrorist leader prior to the invasion that he became after the invasion. And not to say that Saddam Hussein was a fantastic person and that there shouldn't be some kind of consequences for everything that he did. At the same time, we didn't plan for an invasion and to take over a country, United States, I should say, and to occupy that territory in a way that was going to benefit the Iraqi people. We forgot about governance. We forgot about electricity, schools, food. There was nothing in place to replace any of that after they got rid of all the Ba'athists.
And you were there in the summer of 2003. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Neda Bakos, our guest on Radio Times today. She's the author of a new book called The Targeter, My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House, taking us back to the war in Iraq. We've got a couple of questions here, but one of the things you say in response to when Vice President Dick Cheney said, well, we'll be greeted as liberators when we invade Iraq, you said, really? I mean, you said it's not going to turn out that way.
I mean, having that kind of confidence is kind of impressive.
That's coming from the Vice President.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Just even think of it from a neighborhood perspective. If you're going into a neighbor's house and you're inviting them to leave and removing them, but you're not providing them other housing or other opportunity, how happy are they going to be about that? Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what we did. We took away the infrastructure that was in place, the government that was in place, providing resources and livelihoods, jobs, security, schools, and we decided that was going to be embraced. And I just can't fathom the lack of planning that went into this is really impressive.
I've often wondered if there had been actual planning, you know, how different would the world be today?
Right.
No way to run that experiment, but I've often thought about that. Well, I mean, if there could have been, you know, a better way to do it.
Absolutely. There is a much, much, much better way to go about doing this.
Let me read a couple of comments. Email from Kyle, who says, in Ken Burns' Vietnam documentary, he says the Vietnam War was the product of a lot of people that meant well but who made misinformed decisions. Can the same be said for the Iraq War?
Well, like I said, I truly think that there were some elements within the White House that were interested in going in invading Iraq. But I think in some cases they did it because they did think removing Saddam would somehow enable democracy to flourish inside of Iraq and spread around the region. I think they really had that ideology in mind.
Bob says the U.S. response to 9/11, which was to invade, devastate, and occupy Iraq and Afghanistan, will be judged as one of the worst things we have ever done as a nation. Do you agree?
I think it's going to be in the top five, probably. Look at the devastation and how long this has gone on. The iteration of ISIS after al-Qaeda in Iraq. This has become such a prolonged war. Syria, obviously, is an element of that war. I think this is for sure going to be, I hope we don't top this, but I think it's for sure in the top five.
Mm. Question from Jean. Can your guest speak to the assassination attempt by Saddam Hussein against George Herbert Walker Bush? Can you speak to that at all?
Sadly, I wasn't able to include that piece in my book, so...
We should say, I mentioned that the U.S. government redacted a lot of your book. I mean, I have to say, I've interviewed people with books with large redactions. Yours does not. But obviously, this was a fight on your part to get this thing published.
It was. Initially, when I had sent the book in, I was hoping it would take maybe 6 months. About a year later, I received a manuscript back that was largely redacted.
Really?
And when I went to try to contact the government... They weren't willing to sit down and have this discussion. And my manuscript not only had to go to the CIA, it had to go to DOD, FBI, NSA, because I worked with so many elements of a government. They all needed to weigh in on their equities. And the CIA had no way of retrieving the manuscript quickly. And once they did, those redactions that are done by other agencies, there's not a lot they can do about that. So I ended up having to file a lawsuit to bring them all to the table so that I could sit down and have a discussion about the way forward and how to go about dealing with the redaction. So I'd have a book.
And when you say U.S. government, which administration was this?
So this was under Obama. It started under Obama.
And then what kept into the Trump administration
yes.
as well?
Yep.
So you were able to convince them that this was – I'm holding the book here
yes.
on the radio – that you were able to convince them that that this could be published?
Yes, after working through many redactions for a couple of days. This was the result.
So was this the book that you originally wrote and they just decided that their redactions were overreacting? Or
I reworked and edited and took out a lot of stuff, but the story is intact. I was able to include a lot of information that I was actually pleasantly surprised retained. So,
do we over either classify things? Do you think there's just too much sort of censorship, I guess, coming from the government when it's about sensitive issues like this?
I think the amorphous guidelines for each agency is a problem. We are always focused on protecting sources and methods, and that means different things to different people. And there's not clear guidelines around that. There's not clear deadlines that they have to adhere to. So the process itself is very broken.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Neda Bakos about her new book, The Targeter, My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House. Several White Houses, I guess. And again, you can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, we are talking about the Iraq War. It's officially over, of course, but the after effects of the U.S.-led invasion are still being felt with things like proxy wars, the rise of ISIS, ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, including the recent attack in Saudi Arabia. Our guest, Neda Bakos, is part of a CIA team, and they were tasked with finding a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda and the September 11th terror attacks. They concluded there was no link, even though the Bush administration kept saying that there was, and that's what she writes about in her book called The Targeter. I should add her job was to track down terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed by the U.S. forces in 2006. You were in Iraq then in the summer of 2003, several months after the U.S.-led invasion. Describe that city for us. What was going on?
I think one of the first things that I noticed was the stark contrast between this, you know, beautiful city that was well laid out. I was marveling at the wide streets, the grid pattern, unlike D.C., how easy it is to get around. And this, you know, that's the backdrop. And then on top of that is all of this chaos from the invasion. Everybody,
and when you say chaos, just chaos,
it's
right?
It's complete chaos. There's zero things in place. So we've now let all of the Ba'athists go, which was the party under Saddam. They don't have jobs. People are trying to figure out ways to get electricity to their house. They're trying to figure out, will the schools be open? Grocery stores are trying to maintain some kind of supply and continue to get food into the country. It was interesting because when I landed at Baghdad International Airport, I was actually having to stay there on the airport itself in an old terminal. And it was me and, you know, 50 of my closest friends inside of a ballroom. And at the time, we were employing locals to cook for us, which was the best option, of course, you know, getting local food.
Giving them jobs,
yes,
right?
Yes, right. This was after we were, you know, tired of the MREs and ended up realizing, oh, there's food to be had somewhere. The first thing that I really thought about was, how are we providing any kind of stability or any kind of infrastructure for this country? All I saw was just military action of looking for bad guys, looking for, you know, we had the deck of cards for the former regime members. I was still focused on trying to figure out if Sir Kelly was still inside of Iraq and if he was building a network and who those people were. That was really the whole focus at that point, rather than thinking about, you know, this coalition government that we're building is really just based on the United States and its coalition partners. It wasn't trying to figure out how are we really going to immediately let this country become this own independent organization. Mm.
Your job there was, I mean, you did interview people. I mean, as you said, your mission, your job was to figure out Zarqawi and what he was doing, I guess, and whatever connections he had to al-Qaeda. And in interrogating people or interviewing people, did anyone give you something that, to sort of hang what the Bush administration was looking for?
No, not really. We didn't end up finding any information or any evidence that Saddam had worked with Zarqawi, and we knew that Zarqawi had not yet been a member of al-Qaeda. So during that whole time, we're still looking backwards. Rather than thinking about the threats that are in front of us and those that are currently killing military members, we're looking at looking for evidence to justify the war still at that point.
You do describe, and we have, you know, learned since then about these black sites where there were really, I mean, there was harsh interrogation or torture, however you want to describe it, going on there. Were you aware of that at the time?
So they weren't inside of Iraq. That was a CIA program ran in various other countries. And at the time that I was in Iraq, I wasn't aware of those. It wasn't until much later when I was in the counterterrorism center on the ops side that I understood that was a separate program by itself. And at the time when I was having to interview detainees, they were in U.S. military custody, and I would end up having to talk to them in like a plywood shack, just made up room in the middle of like a dirt warehouse that had actually been attacked. So while it wasn't glamorous quarters, it was far from the CIA's program.
Right, right. What do you think about that program? I mean, now I think it's been largely repudiated, but it was happening.
Right. And my understanding from some of the senior members who worked in the CTC, Counterterrorism Center at the CIA at the time, was that program was initially intended to work and function like 72 hours after 9/11 and be done. It was really to understand immediate threats from like KSM and people like that. And not continue on.
Yeah.
And the fact that it just continued on, I think, was sort of a surprise to everybody. And I don't think it's useful. I think it hurts us much more than it would help us. I don't know, this whole conversation around whether or not we had valid intelligence from that program, I think, is just even the wrong question. Yeah. It just doesn't matter. I think we just make the choice to not do that.
Do you think we've learned any lessons from this time, from the Iraq War, and what led up to it and what happened afterwards?
That is a very good question. I think it just depends on the administration that we have in the United States at any given time, on whether or not we've learned those lessons.
I want to jump ahead, but let me just read a couple of emails here. One from Becky, who says, these wars are all about people making money. An email from Brennan, American imperialism is a greater threat than any of the countries that we have invaded in the past 60 years. Comment from Harry, I think it's important to put the Iraq war into the context of the neoliberal policy agenda that was dominant at the time. An email from Jim, how did your guests feel in the lead up to the beginnings of the Iraq war when people who opposed the war were attacked for questioning the decision? Question from Eric, weapons of mass destruction, ? And we did not find weapons of mass destruction.
Right. There was no evidence of anything that was an immediate, urgent threat. And it's interesting. When you go back and read the National Intelligence Estimate, and I did not work on the WMD side, but when you go back and read the intelligence estimate, it actually says there's not an imminent threat, which...
It's there in black and white.
It is. But when we talk about it, even today, we talk about it as there was an urgent need to go find WMD. This is the same, to me, the same sort of spin on, you know, Al-Qaeda having something to do with Saddam's regime.
Now, Zarqawi was killed by the United States.
Yes.
In an airstrike, right?
Yes.
Did that in any way sort of end his brand of terrorism?
As we know, it didn't. He had a replacement in place. He actually had a whole playbook that he had assembled along with a senior member of Al-Qaeda after he had joined Al-Qaeda on how to build a caliphate. And so he had several steps that he was trying to complete prior to building a caliphate. And when that was handed off to his successor and he was killed, the successor, we then ended up with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who then just developed his own organization
under ISIS,
that umbrella,
right?
As ISIS. And he picked up that same playbook and skipped several steps and started building what we know as the caliphate that they were building at the time.
The White House announced actually over the weekend that Osama bin Laden's son was killed. And in the, I guess it's the AP here, it says, was seen as a future Al-Qaeda leader. What is Al-Qaeda today? Do we know?
Al-Qaeda is very different than ISIS, where they're a covert organization. Their whole purpose for existing is as a covert terrorist organization, where ISIS was really trying to govern. They were out in the open, very forthcoming about their plans, and they intended to rule territory. Al-Qaeda continues to focus on the United States and allies, mainly the same reasons that bin Laden put forward before 9/11. So I don't discount Al-Qaeda still being a formidable terrorist organization because of the way that they conduct their activities. They're in it for the long term.
And the fact that we haven't had the scale of attack that we had on September 11th, 18 years ago, what does that tell us, if anything? I mean, I'm assuming attacks have been foiled. We just don't know about it.
Right. That is true. But at the same time, I think that putting deterrence in place is helpful. I do think the fact that Al-Qaeda has been kept off their game by the United States continually looking for them. Right after 9/11, they had a lot of their rank had been decimated. So I do think that they've had impacts against the organization. But at the same time, we've had our own set of challenges here in the United States, you know.
Domestic terrorism,
yes.
You write near the end of the book, you left the CIA after about 10 years, but you write about really having PTSD. Diagnose you here, but PTSD as a result of what, just being on the front lines, not just being, but being on the front lines?
I think PTSD is manifest differently for everybody, but there is always, you know, elements I think that are probably the same for everyone, the shared guilt, exposure to violence, everything that is encompassed in that. And I have friends who were never even in Iraq that were analysts that had to see this stuff over and over again that were also responsible for communicating to the policymaker that ended up feeling like they had PTSD.
You write, these days it comes during unwelcome moments when the brutality of war and counterterrorism fill my mind, and I'm left with the shame of war and the emptiness of my own moral dissonance. What could I have done better in my own work? Why didn't I stand up and try to stop what was happening there? I mean, I circled that because I thought it was very moving and a profound thing to say and a very honest thing to say.
And that was the continual question going through the process of trying to heal from the PTSD and going through therapy and finally realizing that I did what I could at the time. I did my job and I did it with integrity, and there was really nothing else I could have done more.
Must feel, I mean, that must relieve some of the burden of guilt.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah.
You think that'll be with you for...
I don't think PTSD ever leaves you necessarily. I think it changes you indefinitely. I just think that you learn to, with therapy and everything, to live with it and cope with it. And it's just, it's not overwhelming and it's not ruling your life.
Nicole says, does your guest see any parallels with the Bush administration's actions with Iraq and the Trump administration's ongoing conflict with Iran?
I think there's parallels in that the administration is trying to analyze in public what the bottom line is. Here's the distinction that I'm seeing is that the Bush administration was really interested in and focused on the intelligence coming from the intelligence community. They, you know, while they are talking in public about trying to spin and make these connections, they still at the same time valued the intel that they were getting.
Even if they rejected it or...
Right. But they were utilizing it. They were utilizing the intelligence. And not the entire administration didn't reject it. It was elements within the administration.
And you're saying under the Trump administration, it doesn't even go that far?
It appears very... very different. It appears he openly rejects the intel community. And I think that's incredibly dangerous for us.
As we know, some Saudi Arabian oil depots or supply lines were attacked over the weekend. President Trump tweeted, this was September 15th, Saudi Arabia oil supply was attacked. There is reason to believe that we know the culprit are locked and loaded depending on verification, but are waiting to hear from the kingdom as to who they believe was the cause of this attack and under what terms we would proceed. You tweeted in response, there is a whole intel community that might have some answers. So what the president is saying is that we're going to depend on Saudi Arabia, where the terrorists came from on September 11th, to decide what our foreign policy is going to be.
Yeah, that whole tweet is so incredibly irresponsible. Almost every single word of it. To say that we're locked and loaded, that's essentially a threat. To discount the intel community and say that you're going to rely on the Saudi Arabian government to tell us who actually conducted this attack. Well, I know that the intel community is probably working in conjunction with Saudi. It's important to listen to our own assessment. We need some objective answers here, and Saudi might not have the most objective answer, and nor should they be dictating our response.
Right. Do you worry that we're going to go to another war in the Middle East? I mean, I hate to ask a speculative question like that.
On one hand, it appears that Trump doesn't want to get involved in another conflict. He wants out of Afghanistan. He wanted us out of Iraq. It's hard to believe that he fired John Bolton because they disagreed about Iran. So some of this could just be him talking on Twitter. But at the same time, what he doesn't realize is how impactful his words are and can be for our allies. This opens a door for Saudi to then take action if they think the United States will back them up.
Because in a sense, the president gave them permission.
Exactly. And then we are then pulled in to an action, military action, if not a war.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but Neda Bakos, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, she's the author of a new book called The Targeter, My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House. She's speaking tonight at the National Liberty Museum in Philadelphia at 6:30. She is also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those questions. Thank you.